Hello and welcome to Dialect. You're listening to Bristol's first podcast, that's Dialect, and our Friday afternoon 2pm slot on BCFM 93.2. This week, pretty much devoted to a chap called Jim Robbins, who's a bit of a jailbird, been out of prison, started his life in a children's home. Plus our weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week, of course, from Jeff Sparks. Dialect's produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2 every Friday afternoon. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square, and the phone number is 0117 989 7733. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753, and we'll have a reminder of those phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and for Bully Watch at the end of the show.
Dearest darling, I have to write to say that I won't be home anymore, 'cause something happened to me as I was driving home, and I'm not the same anymore. Oh, I was only 25 hours from Tulsa. I was only one day away from your arms. I saw the welcome in life, and I thought I'd stop for the night, and that is when I show me way. Yeah.
giving it 110, 20, 30% there, one of Bristol's superstars, Beth Rowley. So joining me now is Jim Robbins. Jim, you've spent a while in jail. I know we were chatting before we started here, and you 11 and a half years in prison. That's a long time.
Yeah, 11 and a half years behind prison doors, different sentences ranging from, my first sentence was 3 years, 4.5 years, 5 years, 2 years, 9 months, and some smaller sentences from sort of 18 weeks to 4 weeks.
I almost feel like you're a dangerous man to know.
Far from it. My street name is Gentleman Jim. I've made mistakes in my life, like many other people. And, you know, I've had a lifestyle that includes addiction, not drug addiction or drink addiction, but gambling addiction, which costs an awful lot of money and need an awful lot of funding. And that led to me, you know, I take responsibility for my actions, but that led to a certain lifestyle, plus a children's home upbringing where I first started gambling when I was six. It was away from getting away from a hard regime in a children's home, the bright lights and the excitement and risk. I like risk.
Well, let's go back to the children's home.
Okay.
Because, you know, for many, that is the state is saying, we're intervening, we're taking this child, we're going to look after this child. What was your situation?
No, my situation was not really that. I was in a children's home. I'm one of four children. I was born in 63. I'm 49 years old. My mum, when I was two, suddenly died of cancer, and my father, who had a job as a painter and decorator, as a working class guy, was left with four children under the age of six. This was the 60s. Working class men were not expected to bring children up on their own, and he couldn't afford nannies. And after a small time of fostering, a place came up for all four of us in one of the Muller homes. And your listeners might be familiar that Muller Road is named after George Muller, and he was an ex-prisoner himself, a German who came to Britain in Victorian times, when there was an awful lot of children on the street because their parents had died of various diseases. And the first Muller home was the, what most people know as Brunel Tech, up Ashley Down Road. And then after the years went on, after the Second World War, there came a need for what they called family group homes. And it was mainly children who were orphans, half orphans, who'd had or had problems with their parents. Maybe their parents were prostitutes. Maybe they took them out stealing. Maybe they just couldn't cope. And so we ended up in one of the Muller homes in Clevedon, Strathmore.
So, okay, so how long were you there for? How many years? Most of your childhood?
Yeah, I was there for 14 years, between the ages of about 2.5 and about 17.5.
So give us an idea of that. Do they have individuals, like an individual social worker that almost replaces an individual parent? Are you able to build relationships with adults who are caring for you?
Well, what happened was it varied on which home you went to and the house parents that were in charge. The home I went to in Clevedon was run, when I first went there in 65, 66, was run by a North London working class cockney called Di Hammond, who'd run the home, all told she ran the home for 23 years. She was a lovely woman. She was almost designed to look after children. She loved children. She was never married. She even had thighs the size to put two of us on each thigh. And so I went there. She called me Just William, actually. Apparently, when I turned up, I refused to call them auntie and uncle for a few months. I have no recollection of this. And hit them with my toy rifle and just called them Di or John or whatever it was. And when I was 10, she could no longer cope. And she moved on to be the matron at the head of the headquarters of the homes in Cotton Park. And she took Bonnie and Tracy with her, two girls who were orphans. And she wanted to take me, but because my dad was still on the scene, I didn't go. But I was one of her favourites. You know, I love her to bits. It almost brings a tear to my eye thinking about her now.
So how old were you when you came out of the children's home then?
Well, once Auntie Di had gone, then a new couple took him with great intentions, Auntie Jean and Uncle Dave. And they come from a different regime. They were sort of happy-clappy Christians, but they were very, very genuine. They were there 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, because they believed it was a call of God. And I don't even think they earned enough money to pay tax. They were genuine people. But the regime they ran, I mean, Auntie Jean would say now that she's done loads of things she wouldn't do now. I mean, discos were evil under her regime. Halloween was evil. Even Doctor Who we weren't allowed to watch. And some nights I would be locked on the street, mainly because they knew I could cope, but they were trying to control me, and I went up against the regime. I didn't accept Christianity just because adults were telling me. I challenged things, like, you know. So it was a bit more difficult under Artie Jean's regime, and just becoming an adult, becoming a teenager is quite difficult anyway. And, you know, that led, really, I started gambling very early, and, you know, I was breaking the law quite early. But there was a lot of dissent in my behaviour because I was up against a regime that I didn't agree with, and I was quite stubborn.
So you think that, your situation at the children's home almost translated it out into a wider society, that you felt you had a point to make. You wanted to decide what was right and what was wrong because you didn't agree with what was happening at the children's home.
Well, a lot of things were sort of subconscious. I think that if you're a child, whether you've got a mother, a father, or a guardian figure in my case, it's far easier to go along with what they say because you get rewarded, you get patted on the back. If you, like me, wanted to question that, that was far more difficult. And I think I've studied child development, and it's quite interesting. If, for instance, you're 2 or 3 years old and your father or your mother says, jump from the tree and I'm going to catch you, you jump, like, you know. So people become absolute. So to put into children's brains, you're either of God or of the devil, you're going to heaven or going to hell, is quite dangerous because that's almost seen as an absolute. And it probably took me till I was 21 to throw off any fear of God. You know, I always challenged it, but to actually feel clean of that, it took me a long time.
I think that's it's a good point you bring out there, because in a way, you know, it's an important decision that everybody makes at some point in their life about, yes, God, this whole God business. You get it. You know, certainly, we're pretty much from the same generation. I was born in 1962. Hmm. It was in schools. It was everywhere when we were growing up. But there is almost a healthy rejection of stuff that you're kind of pre-programmed in when you're once you get to the teenage. You question everything, don't you?
Well, not always, because my sisters went along with it. They all married their first boyfriends. They're all two are sort of in the spectrum of Christianity. Two are probably on the right, and my youngest is on the left of Christianity. So they didn't. I think it's harder. Not everybody rebels. And I think what happens is, it's easier not to rebel. You then, you know, set a social club. It might be a church, you know, where you're sort of social stroking and playing it safe. And I think most people play it safe.
But you didn't.
I didn't play it safe.
No, you didn't. No.
I far from it.
So gambling and crime, what sort of petty crime did you get involved with straight away?
Well, As a kid, I also worked really, really well. I had an early morning paper round. I had an evening paper round. I worked in the Chinese. But I had nothing to show for it because I was gambling. So I had, you know, I come from a market, sort of street trading background. My granddad was a street trader and all that. So I was sort of working as well at the same time. You know, I left school and was the golden boy of what is now Summerfields and now gone defunct. In those days, it was Gateways. And I worked hard at my job to start with, and then I had problems with mental health. After 18 months as the, you know, I was a leading light in their organisation for my age, I suddenly fell into depression. I couldn't understand it. On the surface, life was good. I had a girlfriend, I had respect, I was working, blah, 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 and suddenly, bang, I crashed into depression. So
can you sort of make sense of that now, looking back?
Yeah, I diagnosed in 1995 with bipolar, which is a disorder that most people would know something about now. But when I was first given time off for depression, I didn't know what was happening to me. It was a completely different era, wasn't it? 1981 sort of stuff. And the area manager said, Jim, what's happening? Just go and get drunk. You know, and I didn't know what was happening to myself. And I give every sinew to come back to work, but I was completely dysfunctional. I think Stephen Fry did actually a very good three-part series on bipolar, which most people might be familiar with. And basically, it's a physical illness with mental health symptoms. It's different from other depressions in the sense that most depressions are what they call reactive depressions. You react to an event, like someone finishing with you, losing a job, you know, and various things that could count as losses, like, you know, and you would fall into depression. Bipolar is a chemical imbalance within the brain, and I describe it, I have problems more with the depression side than the ups, and I describe it like a tsunami. Suddenly I start to slow down for no reason, and before long I fall into immense despair when I'm suicidal and all the rest of it, and acted out at times.
So you're, I mean, is this partly your sort of rage against the system? Your frustration with not being able to fulfil your goals, or what do you think drove you into that?
No, bipolar is a physical mental illness. What got me into the criminal sort of thing, I think, was, I think I'm addicted to risk, and I think I'm addicted to acting
adrenaline junkie,
maybe adrenaline, but more sort of like, if I think something's wrong, I don't have the fear of, you know, I must do this job even though they're paying me £6 an hour. No, I believe people who've worked for me in the past, I've paid them £10 an hour in the 80s, whether it be cleaners or whatever, and I always think, like, treat people how you want to be treated. And if someone's gonna sort of disrespect me by paying me £6 an hour and they're creaming off loads of profits in a factory, I'm not prepared to do it, although I have worked in a factory a couple of times.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was watching the old John Ford film, The Grapes of Wrath, recently, which is about the Dust Bowl Depression in the United States,
yes,
where people are lured in, all these workers are lured, yeah, in, being told you're going to get $6 an hour or something, and yeah, when it comes to it, it's 20 cents an hour, and because there's so many people desperate for work. Mm. And I mean, we're actually maybe in danger of a similar sort of situation in Britain with the, you know, with the wider, yeah, sort of austerity, with, you know, and in fact, really, I suppose since the Thatcher era, since the 1980s, we've had always quite a few people chasing every job. Now, that is actually, you know, if you're on the edge of society, then that can be really difficult to deal with, because you know that there's always someone ready to take your place, you know, in a job, and it's easy to get rid of people. So, anyway, what about your father? Because,
well,
you know...
My father's a decent man. He lives very close to this studio, actually. He's 78 years old. He's had a... You know, he's got a standard lift in place. He's had terrible arthritis. And
that's in Lawrence Hill, by the way, around the back of the,
yeah,
the City Academy.
Yeah, he lives Redfield. And, you know, he's a decent man. Unfortunately, he's had tragedy followed by tragedy. Not only did his first wife suddenly die, my mother, after that, he sees his children going to home. He remarries. He has three children from his second marriage. One dies suddenly at the age of 10 with meningitis. One dies in the heart scandal at the BRI age 7. Also, his sister commits suicide, pours paraffin over herself. He gets arthritis at the age of 49 and can't work in the building trade anymore. So he's had a tough life, but basically he's a decent man, you know.
We'll come back and chat to you a bit more about your first days in prison,
yeah,
after some music.
Okay.
Nobody's fault but mine. Nobody's fault but mine. And I said if I should die and my soul becomes lost, then it's nobody's fault but mine. Oh, I got a mother. I got a mother and she could pray. And I said if I should die and my soul becomes lost, it's nobody's fault but mine. And I got a father. I got a father and he can preach. And I said if I should die and my soul becomes lost, then it's nobody's fault but. Thank you.
got a sister, and she can sing, yeah. And I said, if I should die, and my soul becomes lost, then I know it's nobody's fault but mine, yeah. And I said, if I should die, and my soul becomes lost, then it's nobody's fault but mine. And I said, if I should die, and my soul becomes lost, then it's nobody's fault.
Beth Rowley there from her album Sweet Hours, or an EP, I'm not quite sure what it is, but anyway, that's where it's from, Nobody's Fault But Mine. Back now to the conversation with Jim Robbins. Jim, when did you first end up in jail then?
1984, 7 days after my 21st birthday, and I remember it very, very well, like up Horfield. It was for check card fraud, and funny enough, it's the same offence that Stephen Fry's bipolar, he got locked up for check card fraud as well. A lot of people don't realise this. And
okay, just tell us what that is. I mean, this is actually taking somebody's, some individual's, used to be the check guarantee cards, was it?
I didn't take anybody's check guarantee cards. I was given them by people who had taken them, and then I would go to shops.
Given or sold?
Well, no, I'd buy them off the person, like, do you know what I mean? And then I would go to shops, and it's actually called a criminal offence using a false instrument. So you're making out you're this person in those days, and I was purchasing from Dixon's and stuff and buying stuff and then selling the stuff on.
So how long were you inside for that one?
Well, the first time I went inside was just for a month on remand, and then I got a suspended sentence. But it was very different jail in 1984 than what it is in 2012.
So, yeah, tell us about that. Conditions there, well, on remand.
On remand in 1984, Horfield, you went on to D-Wing, all the remand prisoners were on D-Wing, and remands and convicted were separated completely. The only time you would see a convicted prisoner was in the chapel, and drugs would be thrown across and tobacco would be thrown across in exchange to friends or acquaintances.
In the chapel?
In the chapel, because the only place you would meet, because remands and convicts, unlike today, they're all wrapped in together, but you know that's the only place you would see them. And when you're on remand, you were allowed things like a bottle of beer in a day, you were allowed a meal brought in by your partner.
So the idea is you haven't actually been convicted of anything.
You haven't been convicted of anything, yes.
You're waiting to be sentenced, and so there's a bit of a different regime. I suppose this is Police and Criminal Evidence Act or something. A different
Just before the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, which most people might know as PACE, the acronym for it. And, of course, you had so much corruption in those days. There was many men and women on remand who hadn't committed crime, who hadn't committed what the police said. Things were wrote down on contemporaneous notes. There was forced confessions, and you could be on remand like 18 months, 12 months, a lot longer in those days, and then the case get chucked out.
So what do you
and
base
you have no compensation.
That, what do you base that assertion that things are better now than they were in the 80s?
Well, I'm not saying to say that things are better now than they were, but what it boiled down to is there were so many miscarriages of justice that the police and the government were forced to bring in what is now taped interviews, which is the Police and Criminal Evidence Act. I think it first came in 85, was fully implemented in 86. And now when you get cautioned, you've got to get cautioned. Your solicitor's got to be present under choice. You've got to get the choice of the solicitor. And also, you know, it's a taped interview. And it's not interviews at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's not, you know, beaten confessions and planted evidence. So there's far more restrictions on what the police can do, and they're watched over, rightly so. And so if you go in as a prisoner now, there's less miscarriages of justice than there used to be.
So what were the motives for the police putting people on remand and putting them inside when actually maybe they hadn't done anything wrong, as you're alleging?
Well, it got them off the streets. They thought they were at it. It got them off the streets. And the police were under pressure to get somebody for a crime, you know, clear something up. And, you know, I could name so many miscarriages of justice. Loads of them are well-known, some are less well-known.
Well, the most well-known ones are things like the Guildford Four, the Birmingham Six. You know, these are massive miscarriages of justice.
Yes.
Where, you know, there was a major bomb attack and the wrong people were jailed for it, you know, which is an appalling situation.
And some of the evidence is absolutely a joke. I mean, a case closer to home is Gary Mills and Tony Paul, and I think they ended up doing 10 to 12 years. And the evidence was absolutely scandalous, and Gloucester Police still haven't been prosecuted over this case. They've been released. You know, it's been chucked out. It took 12 years, an absolute scandal. Like, you know, a lesser-known case, but people who follow miscarriages of justice might know this. But, you know, equally so with the Birmingham Six, the Guildford Four, you could just go on and on.
Now, Jim, you know, we've had a few people actually on here. We've got someone else next week as well who's a victim of miscarriages of justice. And so it's a good time to maybe to plug the website, which is victimsunite.net with a hyphen in the middle, victims-unite. Okay. Which is one of these websites which helps people who believe they're victims of miscarriages of justice to network, for example, with friendly solicitors and also with others who are in similar situation to sort of share knowledge of how to correct miscarriages of justice. Now, I mean, if you go back a few years, we had Rough Justice, didn't we? We had various things on the telly which would expose these, but they don't really. There isn't this kind of tough investigative journalism on television so much, and it bothers me that maybe these miscarriages of justice are still going on. They're just not being
quite exposed. I'm a victim of two fairly recent ones, only small sentences. TK Maxx. I was convicted of... I got attacked by security in TK Maxx. Hadn't committed a crime, nothing. Long story. But the magistrates believed the security, the police officers coerced with security. TK Maxx in their central store in Bristol suddenly didn't have any CCTV when it suited them. I was also convicted of the Tesco thing, not the riot. The year before, when the building was squatted, I arrived on the demonstration at 11:29. I think I was arrested at 11:35. I ended up getting 4 weeks for that. Now, amazingly, trying to plead not guilty, suddenly there's no CCTV in Stokes Croft. So it still goes on. It goes on a lot. The bottom line is, who are jury going to believe? Are they going to believe David Blunkett introduced the bad character law, which is people's previous can be read out to the jury, so people are getting tried twice? So they've moved the goalposts, so there's still miscarriages of justice, big style, like, you know what I mean? Absolutely. So it's still not a fair system, but it's better than it was.
One of the things that the Victims Unite website talks about is litigants in person, where people have had trouble with solicitors as well. They've hired solicitors who have then maybe told them that they should take an out-of-court settlement that they don't want to take, these kinds of things. So, you know, it's worth remembering that there are people out there who discuss these things. Anyway,
Can
you go on and tell us a bit more about, you know, some of your longer stretches in jail?
Oh, right. Okay. Well, my first sentence was actually 3 years. And I think now, I know at the time it was the highest sentence ever for someone who had breached probation without committing another criminal offence. Basically, to cut a long story short, I was up in court with two older men. I won't name their names. One's dead now anyway. And we were nicked for burglary of Clevedon Cricket Club. This is 1985. And I was up with I was the only one on remand. I was up for a load of additional offences, smashing up police stations, more check card fraud, car theft, commercial burglary, not burglary of someone's house. And I was up in court one day for a bail app, been on remand 4 months. The other two were there. I was in front of a judge who's now dead called Sir Ian Lewis. And there'd been a new hostel set up in Bristol called the New Careers. And he agreed to sending me there. And I went there on a trial, a 6-week trial. I'd done well in the 6 weeks, and then I went in front of another judge called Field Fisher, and his opening line was, I didn't agree with the Sir Ian Lewis letting you out. Judging's a fallible art. However, you've done well at the hostel. I'm going to give you a 2-year probation order, a year at the hostel. And I got out, and my first memory was at St. Paul's Carnival, working the ice cream the next day. And then I left the hostel under a cloud, hadn't committed another criminal offence. But because I breached the order, I had to go back in front of Field Fisher. And he gave me 3 years for the original offences. So I didn't commit another criminal offence and got 3 years.
But I mean, you know, you would surely admit that, you know, you do deserve these.
Well, you deserve know, is, deserve, I mean
you're, what you're doing is you're playing it, you're on your adrenaline, a dangerous game. And you know, there's a chance that you'll get away with what you're doing. There's also a chance that you won't.
I'm not saying that I'm not portraying myself as a victim, far from it. You know, I take responsibility for my actions, but I don't believe that prison is the answer to most things. Anyway, on the 3 years, I got sent to Dartmoor. I started off in Horfield, and Dartmoor Prison then was used as basically the jackboot of capitalism. It was the prison that you were sent to. You're either in for violence or you were subversive within the system. I was subversive.
Why do you talk about capitalism, though? Because, I mean, people who are jailed, why is that in any way to do with sort of fighting capitalism?
Well, what I mean by that is, okay, that's a sweeping generalisation, I suppose. What I mean by that is we live under a system. We live in a capitalist society, and if we break the rules, there's punishments. And if you keep taking the system on and keep taking the system on, the place they had designed for you to adhere to their system was Dartmoor Prison. It was the jackboot. It was everybody was sent there. Some of the crazed were sent there. Some so-called dangerous people were sent there.
I mean, aren't your victims ordinary people like you and I?
Sometimes they are, yes, but sometimes they aren't. I mean, victims, when we talk about victims, I think Starbucks should be arrested, the director then, and locked up. They're avoiding tax at the detriment of the health service, of the cuts that are going on.
I noticed in the paper today, actually, there are millions, they're on payoffs of millions, the directors of Starbucks.
Indeed. I mean, these are the real criminals. But I mean, most people have bank accounts. I don't have one myself. But they're probably the biggest thieves in the world, and it's legal. They charge you for astronomical charges. And basically, what are they doing? I mean, even better is Tesco's. I mean, what do Tesco's actually do? What they probably do is they put up a shed. They call it a big shed. They call it a hypermarket or a supermarket. They put up shelves in there. They put other people's products on the shelves. They sell those products at astronomical prices. In other words, keeping people...
Actually, Tesco's is quite cheap, Jim.
Tesco's is cheap. Well, it isn't, actually. If you look at Tesco's, fruit and veg is dear, and how much are the shareholders making, how much are the workers getting paid? Are they worth more than £6.20, £6.40 or £6.50? I would say so. How much is the management worth?
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and for you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue, clouds of white, bright, blessed safe. What a wonderful world.
Tell us about the conditions in Dartmoor. What was it actually like?
Dartmoor, we got slightly off track there. But the conditions in Dartmoor were grim. Dartmoor Prison, I don't know if anybody's visited it. It's,
I've seen photographs. It's out in the middle of nowhere, isn't it?
Yes, it's a foreboding place. You drive there, there's dark clouds. You don't have pigeons or nice birds, it's crows. They used to have a TV mast outside the jail that was turned off. So when you're on association mixing with other prisoners, you were watching a fuzzy screen. Like, you know, everything was designed there, which it was a tough regime, absolutely. In 1986, we organised a riot about the conditions. And they didn't get wind of this, and I was on a wing called A1, and it was me and a Cornish farmer who were going round. He was in for rustling, and we were going round saying we should kick off, and you know, this isn't. Well, I was saying, yeah. And,
I mean, you're in prison and you want to cause trouble there. Surely that's going to make your stretch longer. Well, it doesn't make sense, does it?
Well, it's the voice of the unheard, isn't it? I mean, we praise riots and disturbances across the globe. Kids work down the mines until people, you know, said this and no more. Women got the vote by people breaking the law. And prison conditions improved considerably after the riots of 1990, which kicked off the day after the poll tax riot in London. So riots do actually sometimes are the voice of the unheard. No one wants violence, but if you look at the word violence, violence actually means to do harm, not necessarily physical harm. Now, I would say Maggie Thatcher was a very violent person, putting tax on milk and various violent things that kept people in poverty, broke up families and all the rest of it. So violence is a term is not just physical harm, it's an act that hurts people.
I mean, if you're rioting, surely, you know, there would be a lot of prison warders who are going to get hurt. Some of those, you know, you may have personal grudges with, but surely some of them are just there to do their job.
Well, in Dartmoor Prison, when this particular riot took place, it ended up just our wing. They came in with riot shields. They battered us. They separated us from the rest of the jail for 6 weeks. They shipped some people out. You know, that's basically what happened. None of the screws got particularly hurt. They injured a lot of us because they're carrying weapons, serious weapons, and they overpowered us in the end. What was more interesting was it was the same night that Michelle jilted Lofty on the aisle at EastEnders, and the picture on the TV was fuzzy, and they said prisoners riot. The Guardian reported after a press release was given out by the prison governor, I believe his name was John Lawrence, that prisoners rioted in A-Hall after they couldn't see the picture properly of EastEnders, you know, rather than saying we were rioting over conditions and all the rest of it.
So what do you think you've learnt from your time in jail?
Learnt, that's an interesting question. I think I've learnt, that's put me on the spot really. I think it's confirmed a lot of my politics. I mean, when I first went to jail, I was just a working class lad who was trying to find his way in the world, deal with a lot of the issues of emotions and stuff like this. And then prison, I think, confirmed what the system is, which there's a class system, there's the haves and there's the have-nots. And if you rebel, there's consequences under this system.
Well, it's certainly the LIBOR scandal, for example, massive fraud on, you know, on billions of pounds, billions of dollars. You know, one of the members of the Cameron cabinet at the moment is Lord Green. Yeah. He was in charge of HSBC when they were using armoured vehicles to run around the money for the Mexican drug cartels. That sort of level doesn't seem to get... Those people don't go to jail, Jim.
No, this is one of the problems. I mean, if you look at the whole of the cabinet, you know, we're talking old Etonians who are running the show. You know, how can they relate to a council estate? How can they relate to working class Bristol? How can they even relate to middle class Bristol? You know, these are people who've got millions of pounds, have never had to strive, have never had to worry about their children and the effects of streets and unlit streets and all the rest of it, you know. And these are the people who are running the country. You know, they don't represent us, like, you know, in any shape or form.
Okay. Now, have you got a message for anyone out there who's thinking of, you know, sort of, I'm going to, a bit like you, like the adrenaline junkie, some people choose rock climbing. Some people choose rock climbing. You chose crime.
Well, no, I don't accept that I chose rock climbing because I like abseiling and risk. But, you know, personally, I think that, you know, if you can avoid prison, avoid it. I think, personally, life's about trying to educate yourself emotionally, intellectually, and, you know, trying to make a living. I mean, you know, I've steered away from that fairly recently. You know, I go to Gamblers Anonymous. I'm dealing with my addictions and sort of mental health issues. And I'm trying to be a better person, like, do you know what I mean? But I've made mistakes, and I think everybody on earth has made mistakes.
But, I mean, can't you right wrongs, change things, change society without breaking the law, without ending up in jail?
Well, this is a big question. I mean, I personally believe that revolution is the only way of changing things. I mean, I think people are sick and tired of politics. I think it shows by how many people who voted, because the choice is rabid capitalism or rabid capitalism. People, they're just so far removed, these, you know, the mainstream politicians, from people's lives.
But hang on, revolution, you know, we've seen revolutions almost always. You know, there's the great aspiration. I mean, we had a revolution, some would say, in Britain in the 1700s, you know, the English Civil War. Always at the end of it, someone comes along with a new system, you know, just to take over. When all the revolutionaries are almost spent, there's a new kind of system comes in.
Well, I would say 2011, the riots in 2011 were revolutionary acts. You know, okay, some of it was misguided and burning people out of their homes is completely wrong, but that anger was there. Why was that anger there? It exploded, that anger. And, you know, people are saying, well, where's my bit of the cake? You know, it's the haves and the have-nots. You know, you've only got to go to the Wild Goose on Stapleton Road. They're serving 400 people a day. Like, do you know what I mean?
This is the free food.
This is a free food place on, you know, you've got food banks all over Bristol on council estates. You know, even in the Forest of Dean now, like, you know, it's a working class area. I got a stepdaughter there, and the poverty gap is growing. You know, her mum's a social worker there, and some of the stories I'm hearing is horrendous. It's worse than Thatcher's 80s. You know, Thatcher invented things like agency work, like, you know, no conditions. Do you know what I mean? Hiring, firing people, you know, no holidays, no contracts, no jobs, you know, and they're just blaming, you know, they want to blame European people when the banker, why aren't the bankers in jail? You know, the billionaires who have treated people's lives like a casino, like, you know, and they're still drinking champagne. They're still in these swanky clubs, you know, and yet the person who's turned to drugs because they can't cope and there's no prospects are suddenly demonized in the tabloid press. You know, this is the present day, you know, the present day Britain, like, you know, it's barbaric and it's going to get worse.
Well, Jim Robbins, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts and, you know, wearing your heart on your sleeve for us today.
Tony, thanks very much. Sadly, we didn't get onto the sort of meat, the nitty gritty of jails, but maybe there'll be another opportunity to speak on your show. Thank you very much as well.
Oh, my. Oh, I. walks on by. There's no other girl I would wait for. This girl I break any day for. She won't have to ask what I'm late for. Won't leave me flat. She's not a girl like that. She's absolutely wonderful and marvelous and so beautiful. And anyone can understand why I'm leaning on a lamppost at the corner of my street in case a certain little lady walks on by. I'm leaning on a lamppost at the corner of my street in case a certain little lady walks on by. Yes, I'm leaning on a lamppost at the corner of my street in case a certain little lady.
Okay, it's time for the weekly What's On Guy with Jeff Sparks. Hi, Jeff.
This is your What's On Guy, starting with Friday, 30th of November. Trash Talk will be performing with support at the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. Also on 30th of November, Beth Rowley will be performing with support from Zervas and Pepper at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m.
And I want to add, if you've not seen Beth live, do it.
And I present Red Hot Chili Pipers. They won the TV talent show When Will I Be Famous. This is from the live album titled Blast Live, and it's the track Highland Cathedral. Into Saturday, 1st of December, Albert Lee will be performing with support at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £20 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 2nd of December, The Damned will be performing with support from the Dickies at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £18 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks very much, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're outside Bristol on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday or Wednesday or even Tuesday nowadays when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Dialects, a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And as promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, 01454 318 753. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening, so until the same time next week, goodbye.
When I woke up this morning, the sun was shining, and I knew today was gonna be a good day. I said to myself, wake up, it's gonna be Johnny boy, what you gonna do with the rest of your day? I said, now I got three boys. Yeah, okay. What you gonna do with the rest of your day? I got a feeling some more good shoes are coming our way. Thank you, thank you, Community Radio Show, for having us on.
beautiful day. It's been a beautiful day. It's been a beautiful day. It's been a beautiful day.